formulated strategy with a person less likely to kill herself if he proceeded other than as her desperation demanded. Answering the needs of a wife incoherent with grief, in no condition to think or act except out of hysteria, was an inexcusable error. He should have heeded his mistrust and contacted immediately the agents who had interviewed him and Dawn at the house the day after the bombing. He should have picked up the phone the moment he understood who Rita Cohn was, even while she was seated in his office. But instead, he had driven directly home from the office, and because he could never calculate a decision free of its emotional impact on those who claimed his love, because seeing them suffer was his greatest hardship, because ignoring their importuning and defying their expectations, even when they wouldn't argue reasonably or to the point, seemed to him an illegitimate use of his superior strength, because he could not disillusion anyone about the kind of selfless son, husband, and father he was, because he had come so highly recommended to everyone. He sat across from Dawn at the kitchen table, watching her deliver a long, sob-racked, half-demented speech, a plea to tell the FBI nothing. Dawn begged him to do whatever the girl wanted. It remained possible for Mary to go unapprehended if only they kept her out of sight until the destruction of the store and the death of Dr. Conlon had been forgotten. If only they hid her somewhere, provided for her, maybe even in another country, until this war-mad witch hunt was over and a new time had begun. Then she could be treated fairly for something she never, never could have done. She's been tricked. And he believed this himself. What else could a father believe? Until he heard it day after day, 100 times a day, from Dawn. So he had turned over the Audrey Hepburn scrapbook, the leotard, the ballet slippers, the stuttering book. And now he was to meet Rita Cohn at a room in the New York Hilton, this time bearing $5,000 in unmarked 20s and 10s. And just as he'd known to call the FBI when she asked for the scrapbook, he now understood that if he acceded any further to her malicious daring, there'd be no bottom to it. There'd be only misery on a scale incomprehensible to all of them. With the scrapbook, the leotard, the ballet slippers, and the stuttering book, he had been craftily set up. Now for the disastrous payoff. But Dawn was convinced that if he traveled over to Manhattan, got himself lost in the crowds, then, at the appointed afternoon hour, certain he wasn't being tailed, made his way to the hotel, Mary herself would be there waiting for him. An absurd fairy tale hope for which there wasn't a shred of justification, but which he didn't have the heart to oppose, not when he saw his wife shedding another layer of sanity whenever the telephone rang. For the first time, she was got up in a skirt and blouse, gaudily floral bargain basement stuff, and wearing high-heeled pumps. When she unsteadily crossed the carpet in them, she looked tinier even than she had in her work boots. The hairdo was as aboriginal as before, but her face, ordinarily a little pot, soulless and unadorned, had been emblazoned with lipstick and painted with eyeshadow, her cheekbones highlighted with pink grease. She looked like a third grader who had ransacked her mother's room, except that the cosmetics caused her expressionlessness to seem even more frighteningly psychopathic than when her face was just unhumanly empty of color. "I have the money," he said, standing in the hotel room doorway towering above her and knowing that what he was doing was as wrong as it could be. "I have the money," he repeated, and prepared himself for the retort about the sweat and the blood of the workers from whom he had stolen it. "Oh, hi, do come in," the girl said. "I'd like you to meet my parents. Mom and Dad, this is Seymour." An act for the factory. An act for the hotel. "Please, do come in. Do make yourself at home." He had the money packed into his briefcase, not just the $5,000 in the 10s and 20s she asked for, but $5,000 more in 50s, a total of $10,000, and with no idea why. What good would any of it do Mary? Mary wouldn't see a penny of it still. He said yet again, summoning all his strength so as not to lose hold, "I've brought the money you requested." He was trying hard to continue to exist as himself, despite the unlikeliness of everything. She had moved on to the bedspread and, with her legs crossed at the ankle and two pillows propped up behind her head, began lightly to sing, "Oh, Lydia, Oh, Lydia, my encyclopedia. Oh, Lydia, the tattooed lady. Was one of the old silly songs he taught his little daughter once they saw that singing. She could always be fluent. Come to fuck Rita Cohen, have you? I've come, he said, to deliver the money. Let's fuck Dad. If you have any feeling for what everyone is going through, come off it, Swede. What do you know about feeling? Why are you treating us like this? Boo-hoo, tell me another. You came here to fuck me. Ask anybody, why does a middle-aged capitalist dog come to a hotel room to meet a young piece of ass to fuck her? Say it, just say it. I came to fuck you good. Say it, Swede. I don't want to say any such thing. Stop all of this, please. I'm 22 years old. I do everything. I do it all. Say it, Swede. Could this lead to Mary? This onslaught of sneering and mockery? She couldn't insult him enough. Was she impersonating someone, acting from a script prepared beforehand? Or was he dealing with a person who couldn't be dealt with because she was mad? She was like a gang member. Was she the gang leader, this tiny white-faced thug? In a gang, the authority is given to the one who is most ruthless. Is she the most ruthless? Or are there others who are worse? Those others who are holding Mary captive right now. Maybe she's the most intelligent, their actress. Maybe she's the most corrupt, their budding whore. Maybe there's all a game to them, middle-class kids out on a spree. Don't I suit you? She asked. No crude desires and a big guy like you? Come on, I'm not such a frightening person. You can't have met your match in little me. Look at you like a naughty boy. A child in terror of being disgraced. Isn't there anything else in there except your famous purity? I bet there is. I bet you've got yourself quite a pillar in there, she said. The pillar of society. What's the aim of all this talk, will you tell me? The aim? Sure. To introduce you to reality, that's the aim. And how much ruthlessness is necessary? To introduce you to reality? To get you to admire reality? To get you to partake of reality? To get you out there on the frontiers of reality? It ain't going to be no picnic, Chaco. He had braced himself not to become entangled in her loathing for him. Not to be affronted by anything she said. He was prepared for the verbal violence and prepared, this time, not to react. She wasn't unintelligent and she wasn't afraid to say anything. He knew that much. But what he had not counted on was lust. An urge. He hadn't counted on being assailed by something other than the verbal violence. Despite the repugnance inspired by the sickly whiteness of her flesh, by the comically childish makeup and the cheap cotton clothes, half reclining on the bed was a young woman, half reclining on a bed, and the Swede himself, the Superman of certainties, was one of the people whom he could not deal with. Poor thing, she said scornfully. Little rimrock rich boy, all locked up like that. Let's fuck daddy. I'll take you to see your daughter. We'll wash your prick and zip up your fly, and I'll take you to where she is. Do I know you will? How do I know you will? Wait. See how things turn out. The worst is you get yourself some 22-year-old gash. Come on, Dad. Come on over to the bed. Stop this. My daughter has nothing to do with any of this. My daughter has nothing to do with you, you little shit. You're not fit to wipe my daughter's shoes. My daughter had nothing to do with that bombing. You know that. Calm down, sweet. Calm down, lover boy. If you want to see your daughter as much as you say, you'll just calm down and you'll come on over here and give Rita Cohen a nice big buck. First the fuck, then the dough. She had raised her knees toward her chest, and now, with either foot planted on the bed, she let her legs fall open. The floral skirt was gathered up by her hips, and she wore no underwear. There, she said softly. Put it right there. Attack there. It's all permissible. Baby. Miss Cohen. He didn't know what to reach for in his estimable strongbox of reactions. This boiling up of something so visceral in with the rhetorical was not the attack he had prepared himself for. She'd brought to the hotel a stick of dynamite to throw. This was it. To blow him up. What is it, dear? She replied. You must speak up like a big boy if you wish to be heard. What does this display have to do with what has happened? Everything, she said. You'll be surprised by what a very clear picture of things you're going to get from this display. She edged her two hands down onto her pubic hair. Look at it, she told him. And by rolling the labial lips outward with her fingers, exposed to him the membranous tissue, veined and mottled and waxy with the moist tulip sheen of flayed flesh. He looked away. It's a jungle down there, she said. Nothing in its place, nothing on the left side like anything on the right side. How many extras are there? Nobody knows, too many to count. There are glands down there. There's another hole, there are flaps. Don't you see what this has to do with what happened? Take a look. Take a good, long look. Miss Cohen, he said, fixing on her eyes, the one mark of beauty she was blessed with. A child's eyes, he discovered. A good child's eyes that had nothing in common with what she was up to. My daughter is missing. Someone is dead. You don't get the point. You don't get the point about anything. Look at it. Describe it to me. Have I got it wrong? What do you see? Do you see anything? No, you don't see anything. You don't see anything because you don't look at anything. This makes no sense, he said. You are subjugating no one by this, only yourself. You know what size it is? Let's see what kind of guesser you are. It's small. I'm guessing that it's a size 4. In a lady's size, that's as small as cunts come. Anything smaller is a child's. Let's see how you'll fit into a teeny size 4. Let's see if a size 4 doesn't provide just the nicest, warmest, snuggest fuck you've ever dreamed of fucking. You love good leather. You love fine gloves. Stick it in, but slowly, slowly. Always the first time, stick it in slowly. Why don't you stop right now? Okay, if that's your decision, that you're such a brave man, you won't even look at it. Shut your eyes and step right up and smell it. Step right up and take a whiff. The swamp, it sucks you and smell it, sweet. You know what a glove smells like? It smells like the inside of a new car. Well, this is what life smells like. Smell this. Smell the inside of a brand new pussy. Her dark child's eyes, full of excitement and fun, full of audacity, full of unreasonableness, full of oddness, full of Rita. And only half of it was performance to agitate, to infuriate, to arouse. She was in an altered state, the imp of upheaval, the genie of disaster, as though in being his tormentor and wrecking his family, she had found the malicious meaning for her own existence. Kid mayhem. Your physical restraint is amazing, she said. Isn't there anything that can get you off dead center? I don't believe there are any left like you. Any other man would have been overcome by his hard-on hours ago. You are a throwback. Taste it. You're not a woman. This doesn't make you a woman in any way. This makes you a travesty of a woman. This is loathsome. Rapidly firing back at her like a soldier under attack. And a man who won't look, what's he a travesty of, she asked him. Isn't it just human nature to look? What about a man always averting his eyes because it's all too steeped in reality for him? Because nothing is in harmony with the world as he knows it, thinks he knows it, tastes it. Of course it's loathsome, you great big boy scout. I'm depraved. And merrily laughing off his refusal to lower his gaze by so much as an inch, she cried, here. She must have reached inside herself with a hand. Her hand must have disappeared inside her because a moment later it was the whole of her hand that she was extending upward to him. The tips of her fingers bore the smell of her right up to him. That he couldn't shut out. The fecund smell released from within. This will unlock the mystery. You want to know what this has to do with what happened, she said? This will tell you. There was so much emotion in him, so much uncertainty, so much inclination and counter-inclination. He was bursting so with impulse and counter-impulse that he could no longer tell which of them had drawn the line that he would not pass over. All his thinking seemed to be taking place in a foreign language, but still he knew not to pass over the line. He wouldn't pick her up and hurl her against the window. He wouldn't pick her up and throw her onto the floor. He wouldn't pick her up for any reason. All the strength left in him would be marshaled to keep him paralyzed at the foot of the bed. He would not go near her. The hand she offered him she now carried slowly up to her face, making loony, comical little circles in the air as she approached her mouth. Then, one by one, she slipped each finger between her lips to cleanse it. You know what it tastes like? Want me to tell you? It tastes like your daughter. Here, he bolted the room with all his strength. That was it. 10, 12 minutes, and it was over. By the time the FBI responded to his phone call and got to the hotel, she was gone, as was the briefcase he had abandoned. He bolted not from the childlike cruelty and meanness, not even from the vicious provocation, but from something that he could no longer name. Faced with something he could not name, he had done everything wrong. 5 years pass. In vain, the Rimrock bomber's father waits for Rita to reappear at his office. He didn't take a photograph, didn't save her fingerprints. No, whenever they met, for those few minutes, she, a child, was boss. And now she's disappeared. With an agent and a sketch artist to assist him, he's asked to construct a picture of Rita for the FBI. While alone, he studies the daily paper and the weekly news magazines, searching for the real thing. He waits for Rita's picture to turn up. She's bound to be there. Bombs are going off everywhere. In Boulder, Colorado, bombs destroy a selective service office and the ROTC headquarters at the University of Colorado. In Michigan, there are explosions at the university and dynamite attacks on a police headquarters and the draft board. In Wisconsin, a bomb destroys a National Guard armory. A small plane flies over and drops two jars filled with gunpowder on an ammunition plant. College buildings are attacked with bombs at the University of Wisconsin. In Chicago, a bomb destroys the memorial statue to the policeman killed in the Haymarket riots. In New Haven, someone firebombs the home of the judge in the trial of 19 Black Panthers, accused of planning to destroy department stores, the police station, and the New Haven Railroad. Buildings are bombed at universities in Oregon, Missouri, and Texas. A Pittsburgh shopping mall, a Washington nightclub, a Maryland courtroom, all bombed. In New York, there are a series of explosions. At the United Fruit Line Pier, at the Marine Midland Bank, at Manufacturers Trust, at General Motors, at the Manhattan headquarters of Mobil Oil, IBM, and General Telephone and Electronics. A downtown Manhattan Selective Service Center is bombed. The Criminal Courts Building is bombed. 3 Molotov cocktails go off in a Manhattan high school. Bombs explode in safe deposit boxes in banks in 8 cities. She has to have set off one of them. They'll find Rita. Catch her red-handed, catch the whole bunch of them, and she will lead them to Mary. In his pajamas in their kitchen, he sits watching every night for her soot-covered face at the window. He sits alone in the kitchen waiting for his enemy, Rita Cohen, to return. A TW agent is bombed in Las Vegas. A bomb goes off on the Queen Elizabeth. A bomb goes off in the Pentagon. In a woman's restroom on the 4th floor of an Air Force area of the Pentagon. The bomber leaves a note. Today we attack the Pentagon, the center of the American military command. We're reacting at a time when growing U.S. air and naval shelling are being carried out against the Vietnamese, while U.S. mines and warships are used to block the harbors of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, while plans for even more escalation are being made in Washington. The Democratic Republic of Vietnam? If I hear that from her once again, Seymour, I swear I'll go out of my mind. It's their daughter. Mary has bombed the Pentagon. Dad, above the noise of the sewing machines, he hears her crying for him in his office. Daddy. 2 years after her disappearance, there's a bomb blast in the most elegant Greek Revival house on the most peaceful residential street in Greenwich Village. 3 explosions and a fire destroy the old 4-story brick townhouse. The house is owned by a prosperous New York couple who are on vacation in the Caribbean. After the explosion, 2 dazed young women stumble, bruised and lacerated, out of the building. One of them, who is naked, is described as being between 16 and 18. The 2 are sheltered by a neighbor. She gives them clothes to wear, but while the neighbor rushes off to the bombed-out building to see what more she can do, the 2 young women disappear. One is the 25-year-old daughter of the owners of the townhouse, a member of a violent revolutionary faction of the Students for a Democratic Society called the Weathermen. The other is unidentified. The other is Rita. The other is Mary. They've roped her into this, too. He waits all night in his kitchen for his daughter and the girl Weatherman. It's safe now. the surveillance of the house, of the factory, the monitoring of the phones would drop more than a year before. It's okay now to show up. He defrosts some soup to feed them. He thinks back to when she had begun to lean toward the sciences. Because of Dawn's cattle, she thought she'd be a vet. It was the stuttering, too, that sent her into the sciences, because when she was focused and concentrated on one of her science projects, doing close work, the stuttering always abated a little. No parent in the world could have seen the connection to a bomb. Everyone would have missed it, not just them. Her interest in science was totally innocent. Everything was. The body of a young man found in the rubble of the burned-out house is identified the next day as that of a one-time Columbia student, a veteran of violent anti-war demonstrations, the founder of a radical SDS splinter group, the Mad Dogs. The following day, the second young woman who fled the bomb scene is identified, another radical activist, but not Mary, the 26-year-old daughter of a left-wing New York lawyer. Even worse is news of another corpse discovered in the rubble at the village townhouse, the torso of a young woman. The body of the second victim of the blast was not immediately identified, and Dr. Elliot Gross, associate medical examiner, said it will take some time before we have any idea who she is. Alone at the kitchen table, her father knows who she is. 60 sticks of dynamite, 30 blasting caps, a cache of homemade bombs, 12-inch pipes packed with dynamite are found only 20 feet from the body. It was a pipe packed with dynamite that blew up Hamlin's. She was putting the components of a new bomb together, did something wrong, and blew up the townhouse. First Hamlin's, now herself. She did do it. Gave the quaint town its big surprise, and this is the result. Dr. Gross confirmed that the torso had a number of puncture wounds caused by nails, giving credence to the report from the police source that the bombs were apparently being wrapped to act more as anti-personnel weapons than just as explosive devices. The next day, more explosions are reported in Manhattan. Three Midtown buildings bombed simultaneously at about 1:40 a.m. The torso, not hers. Mary is alive. Hers is not the body skewered by nails and blown apart. As a result of the telephone warning, police arrived at the building at 1:20 and evacuated 24 janitors and other workers before the explosion occurred. The Midtown bomber and the Rimrock bomber must be one and the same. Had she known enough to telephone before her first bomber set off, no one would have been killed and she would not be wanted for murder. So at least she's learned something. At least she's alive. And there's reason to be sitting every night in the kitchen waiting to see her at the window with Rita. He reads about the parents of the two young women who are missing and wanted for questioning in the townhouse explosion. The mother and father of one of them appealed to their daughter on television to disclose how many people were in the building when it exploded. If there were no others, the mother says, the search could be called off until the surrounding walls are removed. I believe in you, the mother tells the missing daughter, who, with SDS comrades, used the house as a bomb factory, and know that you would not wish to add more sorrow to this tragedy. Please, please, telephone or wire or have someone call for you with this information. There's nothing else we need to know except that you're safe, and nothing we need to say except that we love you and want desperately to help. The very words spoken to the press and television by the father of the Rimrock bomber when she disappeared. We love you and want to help. Asked if he had been communicating well with his daughter, the father of the townhouse bomber replied, and no less truthfully or miserably than the father of the Rimrock bomber answering a similar question, as parents, we'd have to say no, not in recent years. His daughter is quoted by him as fighting for what Mary, too, in her dinner table outburst decrying her selfish mother and father and their bourgeois life, proclaimed as the motive for her own struggle, to change the system and give power to the 90% of the people who have no economic or political control now. The father of the other missing girl is said by the police investigator to be very uncommunicative. He says only, I have no knowledge concerning her whereabouts. And the father of the Rimrock bomber believes him, understands his uncommunicativeness all too well, knows better than any other father in America the burden of anguish concealed by the emotionless formulation, I have no knowledge concerning her whereabouts. If it hadn't happened to him, he would probably have marveled at the tight-lipped facade. But he knows the truth is that the missing girl's parents are drowning, exactly as he is drowning day and night in inadequate explanations. A third body is found in the townhouse rubble, the body of an adult male. Then, a week later, a statement appears in the paper, attributed to the mother of the second missing girl, that dissipates his compassion for both sets of parents. Asked about her daughter, the mother says, "We know she is safe. Their daughter has killed three people, and they know she is safe." While about his daughter, who has not been proved by anyone to have killed anybody, about his daughter, who is being used by radical little thugs, just like these privileged townhouse bombers, who has been framed, who is innocent, he knows nothing. What has he got to do with them? His daughter didn't do it. She no more set off the bomb at Hamlin's than she set off the bomb in the Pentagon. Since 68, thousands of bombs have been exploded in America, and his daughter has had nothing to do with a single one of them. How does he know? Because Dawn knows. Because Dawn knows for sure. Because if their daughter had been going to do it, she would never have gone around school telling kids that the town of Old Rimrock was in for a big surprise. Their daughter was too smart for that. If she had been going to do it, she would have said nothing. 5 years pass. 5 years searching for an explanation, going back over everything. Over the circumstances that shaped her, the people and the events that influenced her. And none of it adequate to begin to explain the bombing until he remembers the Buddhist monks. The self-immolation of the Buddhist monks. Of course, she was just 10 then, maybe 11 years old, and in the years between then and now a million things had happened to her, to them, to the world. Though she had been terrified for weeks afterward, crying about what had appeared on television that night, talking about it, awakened from her sleep by dreaming about it, it hardly stopped her in her tracks. And yet, when he remembers her sitting there and seeing that monk going up in flames, as unprepared as the rest of the country for what she was seeing, a kid half watching the news with her mother and father one night after dinner, he's sure he's unearthed the reason for what happened. It was back in 62 or 63, around the time of the Kennedy assassination, before the war in Vietnam had begun in earnest, when, as far as everybody knew, America was merely at the periphery of whatever was going haywire over there. The monk who did it was in his 70s then, with a shaved head and wearing a saffron robe, cross-legged and straight-backed on an empty city street somewhere in South Vietnam, gracefully seated like that in front of a crowd of monks who had gathered to witness the event as though to observe a religious ritual, the monk had upended a large plastic canister, poured the gasoline or the kerosene, whatever it was, out of the canister and over himself and drenched the asphalt around him. Then he struck the match and a nimbus of ragged flames came roiling out of him. There is sometimes a performer in a circus, advertised as the fire eater, who makes flames seemingly shoot out of his mouth, and there on the street of some city in South Vietnam, this shaven-headed monk somehow made it look as though flames, instead of assaulting him from without, were shooting forward into the air from within him. Not just from his mouth, however, but in an instantaneous eruption from his scalp and his face and his chest and his lap and his legs and his feet. Because he remained perfectly upright, indicating in no way that he could feel himself to be on fire because he did not so much as move a muscle, let alone cry out, it at first looked very much like a circus stunt, as though what was being consumed were not the monk but the air, the monk setting the air on fire while no harm at all befell him. His posture remained exemplary, the posture of someone altogether elsewhere leading another life entirely, a servant of selfless contemplation, meditative, serene, a mere link in the chain of being untouched by what happened to be happening to him within view of the entire world. No screaming, no writhing, just his calmness at the heart of the flames. No pain registering on anyone on camera. Only on Mary and the Swede and Dawn, horrified together in their living room. Out of nowhere and into their home, the nimbus of flames, the upright monk, and the sudden liquefaction before he keels over. Into their home, all these other monks, seated along the curbstone, impassively looking on, a few with their hands pressed together before them in the Asian gesture of peace and unity, into their home on Arcady Hill Road, the charred and blackened corpse on its back in that empty street. That was what had done it. Into their home, the monk came to stay. The Buddhist monk, calmly sitting out his burning up as though he were a man both fully alert and anesthetized. The television transmitting the immolation must have done it. If their set had happened to be tuned to another channel or turned off or broken, if they had all been out together as a family for the evening, Mary would have never seen what she shouldn't have seen and would never have done what she shouldn't have done. What other explanation was there? These gentle people, she said, while the Swede gathered her into his lap. A lanky 11-year-old girl held her to him, rocking and rocking her in his arms. These gentle people. At first, she was so frightened she couldn't even cry. She could get out of her just those three words. Only later, a moment after going to bed, when she got up and with a yelp ran from her room down the corridor and into the room and asked, as she hadn't since she was five, to get into bed with them, was she able to let everything out of her, everything awful that she was thinking. All the lights remained on in their bedroom, and they let her go on and on, sitting up between them in their bed and talking until there were no words left inside her to panic or terrorize. When she fell asleep, sometime after three, it was with their lights all still burning. She wouldn't let him turn them off. But she had at least by then talked herself out enough and cried herself out enough to succumb to her exhaustion. Do you have to melt yourself down in fire to bring people to their senses? Does anybody care? Does anybody have a conscience? Doesn't anybody in this world have a conscience left? Every time conscience crossed her lips, she began to cry. What could they tell her? How could they answer her? Yes, some people have a conscience. Many people have a conscience. But unfortunately, there are people who don't have a conscience. That's true. You're lucky, Mary. You have a very well-developed conscience. It's admirable for someone your age to have such a conscience. We're proud of having a daughter who has so much conscience and who cares so much about the well-being of others and who's able to sympathize with the suffering of others. She couldn't sleep alone in her room for a week. The Swede carefully read the papers in order to be able to explain to her why the monk had done what he did. It had to do with the South Vietnamese president, General Diem. It had to do with corruption, with elections, with the complex regional and political conflicts. It had to do with something about Buddhism itself. But for her, it had only to do with the extremes to which gentle people have to resort in a world where the great majority are without an ounce of conscience. Just when she seemed to have gotten over the self-immolation of that elderly Buddhist monk on that street in South Vietnam and began to be able to sleep in her own room and without a light on and without awakening screaming two and three times a night, it happened again. Another monk in Vietnam set himself on fire, then a third, then a fourth. And once that started up, he found that he couldn't keep her away from the television set. If she missed a self-immolation on the evening news, she got up early to see it on the morning news before she left for school. They didn't know how to stop her. What was she doing by watching and watching as though she intended never to stop watching? He wanted her to be not upset, but not to be not upset like this. Was she simply trying to make sense of it, to master her fear of it? Was she trying to figure out what it was like to be able to do something like that to yourself? Was she imagining herself as one of these monks? Was she watching because she was still appalled, or was she watching now because she was excited? What was starting to unsettle him, to frighten him, was the idea that Mary was less horrified now than curious. And soon he himself became obsessed, though not like her by the self-immolators in Vietnam, but by the change of demeanor in his 11-year-old. That she'd always wanted to know things had made him tremendously proud of her from the time she was small. But did he really want her to want to know so much about something like this? Is it a sin to take your own life? How can the others stand by and just watch? Why don't they stop him? Why don't they put out the flames? They stand by and let it be televised. They want it televised. Where has their morality gone? What about the morality of the television crews who are doing the filming? Were these the questions she was asking herself? Were they a necessary part of her intellectual development? He didn't know. She watched in total silence, as still as the monk at the center of the flames, and afterwards, she would say nothing. Even if he spoke to her, questioned her, she just sat transfixed before that set for minutes on end, her gaze focused somewhere else than on the flickering screen, focused inward. Inward, where the coherence and the certainty was supposed to be, where everything she did not know was initiating a gigantic upheaval, where nothing that registered would ever fade away. Though he didn't know how to stop her, he did try to find ways to divert her attention, to make her forget this madness that was going on halfway around the world for reasons having nothing to do with her or her family. He took her at night to drive golf balls with him. He took her to a couple of Yankee games. He took her and Dawn for a quick trip down to the factory in Puerto Rico and a week of vacation in Ponce by the beach. And then, one day, she did forget. But not because of anything he had done. It had to do with the immolations. They stopped. There were 5, 6, 7 immolations, and then there were no more. And shortly thereafter, Mary did become herself again, thinking again about things immediate to her daily life and more appropriate to her years. When this South Vietnamese President Diem, the man against whom the martyred Buddhist monks had been directing their protest, when some months later he was assassinated, according to a CBS Sunday morning show, assassinated by the USA, by the CIA, who had propped him up in power in the first place, the news seemed to pass Mary by, and the Swede didn't convey it to her. By then, this place called Vietnam no longer even existed for Mary, if it ever had, except as an alien, unimaginable backdrop for a ghastly TV spectacle that had embedded itself in her impressionable mind when she was 11 years old. She never spoke again of the martyrdom of the Buddhist monks, even after she became so committed to her own political protest. The fate of those monks, back in 1963, appeared to have nothing whatsoever to do with what galvanized into expression in 1968, a newly hatched vehemence against capitalist America's imperialist involvement in a peasant war of national liberation. And yet, her father spent days and nights trying to convince himself that no other explanation existed, that nothing else sufficiently awful had ever happened to her. Nothing causal, even remotely large enough or shocking enough to explain how his daughter could be the bomber. 5 years pass. Angela Davis, a black philosophy professor of about Rita Cohen's age, born in Alabama in 1944, 8 years before the birth in New Jersey of the Rimrock bomber, a communist professor at UCLA who is against the war, is tried in San Francisco for kidnapping, murder, and conspiracy. She's charged with supplying guns used in an armed attempt to free 3 black San Quentin convicts during their trial. A shotgun that killed the trial judge is said to have been purchased by her only days before the courthouse battle. For 2 months, she lived underground dodging the FBI until she was apprehended in New York and extradited to California. All around the world, as far away as France and Algeria and the Soviet Union, her supporters claim that she's the victim of a political frame-up. Everywhere she is transported by the police as a prisoner, blacks and whites are waiting in the nearby streets, holding up placards for the TV cameras and shouting, "Free Angela, end political repression, end racism, end the war." Her hair reminds the Swede of Rita Cohen. Every time he sees that bush encircling her head, he's reminded of what he should have done that afternoon in the hotel. He shouldn't have let her get away from him no matter what. Now he watches the news to see Angela Davis. He reads everything he can about her. He knows that Angela Davis can get him to his daughter. He remembers how, when Mary was still at home, he went into her room one Saturday when she was off in New York, opened the bottom drawer of the dresser, and seated at her desk, read through everything in there. All that political stuff, the pamphlets, the paperbacks, the mimeograph booklets with these satiric cartoons. There was a copy of the Communist Manifesto. Where did she get that? Not an old Rimrock. Who was supplying her with all this literature? Bill and Melissa. These weren't just diatribes against the war. They were written by people wanting to overthrow capitalism and the U.S. government. people screaming for violence and revolution. It was awful for him to come upon passages that, being the good student she was, she had neatly underlined. But he couldn't stop reading, and now he believes he can remember something in that drawer written by Angela Davis. There was no way of his knowing for sure because the FBI had confiscated it all, put all those publications into evidence bags, sealed them, and removed them from his house. They had dusted her room looking for a solid set of fingerprints that they could use to match up with anything incriminating. They collected the household phone bills to trace Mary's calls. They searched her room for hiding places, pried up floorboards from beneath a rug, removed wainscoting from the walls, took the globe off the ceiling. Like they went through her clothes in her closet, looking for things hidden in the sleeves. After the bombing, the state police stopped all traffic on Arcady Hill Road, closed off the area, and 12 FBI agents spent 16 hours combing the house from the attic to the basement when finally, in the kitchen, they searched the dust bag of the vacuum cleaner for papers. Dawn had let out a scream, and all because of Mary's reading Karl Marx and Angela Davis. Yes, now he remembers clearly sitting at Mary's desk, trying to read Angela Davis himself working at it, wondering how his child did it, thinking, reading this stuff is like deep sea diving. It's like being in an aqua lung with the window right up against your face and the air in your mouth and no place to go, no place to move, no place to put a crowbar and escape. It's like reading those tiny pamphlets and illustrated holy cards about the saints that the old lady Dwyer used to give her in Elizabeth. Luckily, the child outgrew them, but for a while, whenever she misplaced her fountain pen, she'd pray to St. Anthony, and whenever she thought she hadn't studied enough for a test, she prayed to St. Jude, and when her mother made her spend a Saturday morning cleaning up her messy room, she prayed to St. Joseph, the patron saint of laborers. Once, when she was 9 and some diehards down at Cape May reported that the Virgin Mary appeared to their children in their barbecue and people flocked in from miles around and kept vigil in their yard, Mary was fascinated. Perhaps less by the mystery of the Virgin's appearance in New Jersey than by a child's having been singled out to see her. "I wish I could see that," she told her father, and she told him about how apparitions of the Virgin Mary had appeared to 3 shepherd children in Fatima, in Portugal, and he nodded and held his tongue, though when her grandfather got wind of the Cape May vision from his granddaughter, he said to her, "I guess next I'll see her at the Dairy Queen," a remark Mary repeated down in Elizabeth. Grandma Dwyer then prayed to St. Anne to help Mary stay Catholic despite her upbringing, but in a couple of years, saints and prayer had disappeared from Mary's life. She stopped wearing the miraculous medal with the impression on it of the Blessed Virgin, which she had sworn to Grandma Dwyer to wear perpetually without even taking it off to bathe. She outgrew the saints just as she would have outgrown the communism. And she would have outgrown it. Mary outgrew everything. It was merely a matter of months, maybe weeks, and the stuff in that drawer would have been completely forgotten. All she had to do was wait. If only she could have waited. That was Mary's story in a nutshell. She was impatient. She was always impatient. Maybe it was the stuttering that made her impatient. I don't know. But whatever it was she was passionate about, she was passionate for a year. She did it in a year, and then she got rid of it overnight. Another year and she would have been ready for college, and by then she would have found something new to hate and new to love, something new to be intense about, and that would have been that. At a kitchen table one night, Angela Davis appears to the Swede, as Our Lady of Fatima did to those children in Portugal, as the Blessed Virgin did down in Cape May. He thinks, Angela Davis can get me to her, and there she is. Alone in the kitchen at night, the Swede begins to have heart-to-heart talks with Angela Davis, at first about the war, then about everything important to both of them. As he envisions her, she has long lashes and wears large hoop earrings and is more beautiful even than she looks on television. Her legs are long, and she wears colorful mini-dresses to expose them. The hair is extraordinary. She peers defiantly out of it like a porcupine. The hair says, "Do not approach if you don't like pain." He tells her whatever she wants to hear, and whatever she tells him, he believes. He has to. She praises his daughter, whom she calls a soldier of freedom, a pioneer in the great struggle against repression. He should take pride in her political boldness, she says. The anti-war movement is an anti-imperialist movement, and by lodging a protest in the only way America understands, Mary at 16 is in the forefront of the movement, a Joan of Arc of the movement. His daughter is the spearhead of the popular resistance to a fascist government and its terrorist suppression of dissent. What she did was criminal only in as much as it is defined as criminal by a state that is itself criminal and will commit ruthless aggression anywhere in the world to preserve the unequal distribution of wealth and the oppressive institutions of class domination. The disobedience of oppressive laws, she explains to him, including violent disobedience, goes back to abolitionism. His daughter is one with John Brown. Mary's was not a criminal act, but a political act in the power struggle between the counter-revolutionary fascists and the forces of resistance, blacks, Chicanos, Puerto Ricans, Indians, draft resistors, anti-war activists, heroic white kids like Mary herself, working either by legal means or by what Angela calls extra-legal means to overthrow the capitalist-inspired police state. And he shouldn't fear for her future life. Mary's not alone. She's part of an army of 80,000 radical young people who have gone underground the better to fight the social wrongs fostered by an oppressive politico-economic order. Angela tells him that everything he's heard about communism is a lie. He must go to Cuba if he wants to see a social order that has abolished racial injustice and the exploitation of labor and is in harmony with the needs and aspirations of its people. Obediently, he listens. She tells him that imperialism is a weapon used by wealthy whites to pay black workers less for their work. And that's when he seizes the opportunity to tell her about the black forelady, Vicky, 30 years with Newark Maid, a tiny woman of impressive wit, stamina, and honesty, with twin sons, Newark Rutgers graduates, Donnie and Blaine, both of them now in medical school. He tells her how Vicky alone stayed with him in the building round the clock during the 67 riots. On the radio, the mayor's office was advising everyone to get out of the city immediately, but he had stayed because he thought that by being there, he could perhaps protect the building from the vandals, and also for the reason that people stay when a hurricane hits, because they cannot leave behind the things they cherish. For something like that reason, Vicky stayed. In order to appease any rioters who might be heading from South Orange Avenue with their torches, Vicky had made signs and stuck them where they would be visible, in Newark Maid's first floor windows, big white cardboard signs in black ink. Most of this factory's employees are Negroes. 2 nights later, every window with a sign displayed in it was shut out by a band of white guys, either vigilantes from North Newark or, as Vicky suspected, Newark cops in an unmarked car. They shot the windows out and drove away, and that was the total damage done to the Newark Maid factory during the days and nights when Newark was on fire. And he tells this to St. Angela. A platoon of the young National Guardsmen who were on Bergen Street to seal off the riot zone had camped out back by the Newark Maid loading dock on the second day of fighting, and when he and Vicky went down with hot coffee, Vicky talked to each of them. Uniformed kids in helmets and boots, conspicuously armed with knives and rifles and bayonets, white country boys up from South Jersey who were scared out of their wits. Vicky told them, "Think before you shoot into somebody's window. These aren't snipers. These are people. These are good people. Think." The Saturday afternoon, the tank sat out in front of the factory, and the suite, seeing it there, could at last phone Dawn to tell her, "We'll make it." Vicky had gone up and knocked on the lid with her fist until they opened up. "Don't go nuts," she shouted at the soldiers inside. "Don't go crazy. People have to live here when you're gone. This place is their home." There'd been a lot of criticism afterwards of Governor Hughes for sending in tanks, but not from the Swede. Those tanks put a stop to what could have been a total disaster. Though this he does not say to Angela. For the two worst, most terrifying days, Friday and Saturday, July 14th and 15th, 1967, while he kept in touch with the state police on a walkie-talkie and with his father on the phone, Vicky would not desert him. She told him, "This is mine, too. You just own it." He tells Angela how he knew the way things worked between Vicky and his family, knew it was an old and lasting relationship, knew how close they all were. But he had never properly understood that her devotion to Newark Maid was no less than his. He tells Angela how, after the riots, after living under siege with Vicky at his side, he was determined to stand alone and not leave Newark and abandon his black employees. He does not, of course, tell her that he wouldn't have hesitated, and wouldn't still, to pick up and move were it not for his fear that, if he should join the exodus of businesses not yet burned down, Mary would at last have her airtight case against him. Victimizing black people and the working class and the poor solely for self-gain out of filthy greed. In the idealistic slogans, there was no reality, not a drop of it. And yet, what else could he do? He couldn't provide his daughter with the justification for doing something crazy. So he stayed in Newark, and after the riots, Mary did something crazier than crazy. The Newark riots, then the Vietnam War, the city, then the entire country, and that took care of the Seymour LaBeouf's of Arcady Hill Road. First, the one colossal blow. 7 months later, in February 68, the devastation of the next. The factory under siege, the daughter at large, and that took care of their future. On top of everything else, after the sniper fire ended and the flames were extinguished and 21 Newarkers were counted dead by gunfire and the National Guard was withdrawn and Mary had disappeared, the quality of the Newark Maid line began to fall off because of negligence and indifference on the part of his employees, a marked decline in workmanship that had the effect of sabotage, even if he couldn't call it that. He doesn't tell Angela, for all that he's tempted to, about the struggle his decision to stay on in Newark has precipitated between himself and his own father. Might only antagonize her against Lou LaVov and deter her from leading them to Mary. What we've got now, his father argued each time he flew up from Florida to plead with his son to get the hell out before a second riot destroyed the rest of the city, is that every step of the way, we're no longer making one step. We're making two, three, and four steps. Every step of the way, you have to go back a step to get it cut again, to get it stitched again. And nobody is doing a day's work, and nobody is doing it right. A whole business is going down the drain because of that son of a bitch, Leroy Jones, that peek-a-boo-boopy-doo, whatever the hell he calls himself, in that goddamn hat. I built this with my hands, with my blood. They think somebody gave it to me? Who? Who gave it to me? Who gave me anything, ever? Nobody. What I have, I built with work. W-O-R-K. But they took that city, and now they are going to take that business and everything that I built up a day at a time, an inch at a time, and they are going to leave it all in ruins. And that'll do them a world of good. They'll burn down their own houses. They'll show Whitey. Don't fix them up. Burn them down. Oh, that'll do wonders for man's black pride. A totally ruined city to live in. A great city turned into a total nowhere. They're just going to love living in that. And I hired them. How's that, Philip? I hired them. You're nuts, LaVov. This is what my friends in the steam room used to tell me. What are you hiring Schwartzes for? You won't get gloves, LaVov. You'll get track. But I hired them, treated them like human beings, kissed Vicky's ass for 25 years, bought all the girls at Thanksgiving turkey every goddamn Thanksgiving, came in every morning with my tongue hanging out of my mouth so I could lick their asses with it. How is everybody, I say? How are we all? My time is yours. I don't want you complaining to anybody but me. Here at this desk isn't just a boss. Here is your ally, your buddy, your friend. And the party I gave for Vicky's twins when they graduated? What a jerk off I was. Am. To this day. I'm by the pool and my wonderful friends look up from the paper and they tell me they ought to take the Schwartzes out and line them up and shoot them. And I'm the one who has to remind them that's what Hitler did to the Jews. And you know what they tell me as an answer? How can you compare Schwartzes to Jews? They're telling me to shoot the Schwartzes, and I'm hollering no. And meanwhile, I'm the one whose business they are ruining because they cannot make a glove that fits. Bad cutting, the stretch is wrong. The glove won't even go on. Careless people, careless. And it's inexcusable. One operation goes wrong, the whole operation is spoiled all the way through. And still, when I'm arguing with these fascist bastards, Seymour, Jewish men, men of my age, who have seen what I've seen, who should know better a million times over, when I'm arguing with them, I'm arguing against what I should be arguing for. Well, sometimes you wind up doing that, the Swede said. Why? Tell me, why? I suppose out of, conscience. Conscience? Where is theirs? The Schwartz's conscience. Where is their conscience after working for me for 25 years?
Whatever it cost him to deny his father relief from his suffering, stubbornly to defy the truth of what his father was saying, the Swede could not submit to the old man's arguments for the simple reason that if Mary were to learn, and she would, through Rita Cohen, if Rita Cohen actually had anything to do with her, that Newark Maid had fled the Central Avenue factory, she would be all too delighted to think, he did it. He's as rotten as the rest, my own father. Everything justified by the profit principle, everything. Newark's just a black colony for my own father. Exploited and exploited, and then when there's trouble, fuck it. These thoughts, and thoughts even stupider, engendered in her by the likes of the Communist Manifesto, would surely foreclose any chance of ever seeing her again. Despite all that he could tell Angela Davis that might favorably influence her about his refusal to desert Newark and his black employees, he knows that the personal complications of that decision could not begin to conform to the utter otherworldliness of the ideal of St. Angela. And so he decides, instead, to explain to a vision that he is one of two white trustees. This is not true. The father of a friend is the trustee of an anti-poverty organization that meets regularly in Newark to promote the city's comeback, which, also not true, how could it be, he still believes in. He tells Angela that he attends evening meetings all over Newark despite his wife's fears. He's trying to do everything he can for the liberation of her people. He reminds himself to repeat these words to her every night. The liberation of the people, America's black colonies, the inhumanity of the society, embattled humanity. He does not tell Angela that his daughter is childishly boasting, lying in order to impress her, that his daughter knows nothing about dynamite or revolution, that these are just words to her and she blurts them out to make herself feel powerful despite her speech impediment. No, Angela is the person who knows Mary's whereabouts, and if Angela has come to him like this, it's no mere friendly visit. Why would Angela Davis drop out of nowhere into the LaBov's old rim rock kitchen at midnight every single night if she weren't the revolutionary leader assigned to looking after his daughter's well-being? What's in it for her otherwise? Why else would she keep coming back? So he says to her, yes, his daughter is a soldier of freedom. Yes, he is proud. Yes, everything he's heard about communism is a lie. Yes, the United States is concerned solely with making the world safe for business and keeping the have-nots from encroaching on the haves. Yes, the United States is responsible for oppression everywhere. Everything is justified by her cause. Huey Newton's cause. Bobby Seale's cause. George Jackson's cause. Mary LaVov's cause. Meanwhile, he mentions Angela's name to no one, certainly not to Vicky, who thinks Angela Davis is a troublemaker and who says as much to the girls at work. Alone, then, and in secret, he prays, ardently prays to God, to Jesus, to anyone, to the Blessed Virgin, to St. Anthony, St. Jude, St. Anne, St. Joseph, for Angela's acquittal. And when it happens, he's jubilant. She is free. But he doesn't send to the letter that he sits up writing in the kitchen that night. Nor does he some weeks later when Angela, in New York, behind a four-sided shield of bulletproof glass and before 15,000 exultant supporters, demands the freedom of political prisoners deprived of due process and unjustly imprisoned. Free the Rim Rock bomber. Free my daughter. Free her, please, cries the Swede. I think it's about time, Angela says, for all of us to begin to teach the rulers of this country a few lessons. And yes, cries the Swede, yes, it is about time. A socialist revolution in the United States of America. But nonetheless, he remains alone at his kitchen table because he still can't do anything that he should do, or believe anything that he should believe, or even know any longer what it is he does believe. Did she do it or didn't she do it? You should have fucked Rita Cohen. If only to find out, fuck the conniving little sexual terrorist until she was his slave. Until she took him to the hideout where they made the bombs. If you want to see your daughter as much as you say, you'll just calm down and come over here and give Rita Cohen a nice big fuck. He should have looked at her cunt and tasted it and fucked her. Is that what any father would have done? If he would do anything for Mary, why not that? Why did he run? And this is just a part of what is meant by 5 years pass. A very tiny part. Everything he reads or sees or hears has a single significance. Nothing is impersonally perceived. For one whole year, he cannot go into the village without seeing where the general store used to be. To buy a newspaper, a quart of milk, or a tank of gas, he has to drive almost clear into Morristown, and so does everybody else in Old Rimrock. The same to buy a stamp. Basically, the village is one street. Going east, there is the New Presbyterian Church, a white, pseudo-colonial building that doesn't look like much of anything, and that replaced the old Presbyterian church that burned to the ground in the 20s. Just a little ways from the church are the oaks